Welcome to No Such Podcast, your weekly mission briefing for the week of May 10th, 2020. We are back after a one-week vacation to talk about the 2008 Tom Cruise movie Valkyrie and the real-life plot to assassinate Hitler that inspired the film. All of this, plus your weekly intelligence news update, general tomfoolery, and more. Stay tuned.
Greetings, operator. No Such Podcast is your weekly mission briefing source. The following message is for your ears only. Good luck, operator. We're counting on you.
Okay, welcome back. I am joined this week by special guest co-host Nate Quashy. Hey, Nate.
Yo.
Good to have you back. This week we watched Valkyrie, 2008, Bryan Singer directed Tom Cruise movie about the 20th July plot to overthrow Adolf Hitler. Now, before we get into it, Nate, I got to tell you, Tom Cruise is a terrible actor. I never realized it before.
Well, when we started it, I'm sitting here like, okay, I don't feel like he's a German at all. He just felt too American. And I complained to you and you're just like, yeah, he's just being Tom Cruise. And I realize he's just Tom Cruise in every movie.
Yeah.
When he's supposed to be in Japan, he's just Tom Cruise.
Well, it was a striking realization, right? Tom Cruise is one of the most famous American actors, and yet I don't think he can actually act. I think he's honestly just being Tom Cruise all the time.
No, he just runs, and they didn't let him run in this one. So,
well, I mean, you know, he was playing a German aristocrat. I don't think it would have been proper for him to run.
He looked like he was itching to do it, though.
He did hustle a little bit on the way to a car, right? Okay, so let's get into the movie. So it's based off of a real plot by some German officers to assassinate Adolf Hitler pretty close to the end of World War II. He was kind of going senile from being riddled with syphilis and other debilitating diseases. And
which you could see in the movie, he did not look good.
Yeah, they did do a really good job with the portrayal of Hitler in this one, yeah.
And the discoloration on his knuckles, and he looked all pale and hunched and everything.
Yeah, they did a good job showing him as kind of falling apart. It was really a really accurate representation, I thought. So overall, actually, I think the movie was quite accurate. I think they
except
for Tom Cruise, right? And you know, one of the things is that in all of these movies about Nazis and stuff, we always portray the Nazis as like hoity-toity British dudes, and so we have pretty much a whole cast of hoity-toity British dudes playing Nazis, and then we have Tom Cruise, who's basically like an American cowboy. It's really weird.
Yeah. Well, he tried to. He had to be more subdued than he normally gets to be with the running and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked like he had to work hard at it when you look at his face the whole time.
Yeah. So, all right, let's get into the movie. So we open up in Tunisia with Tom Cruise playing Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg. Klaus von Stauffenberg was a count, I believe.
Yes.
Who was a colonel in the German Wehrmacht, the army. And he was sent to Tunisia, we understand, because he was not an order follower, I guess, if you want to put it that way. And so the opening shot that we have of von Stauffenberg is him writing in a journal, basically talking about how bad Hitler is for Germany. Now, can you imagine if anybody had ever just found his journal, you know, oh, hey, this is the colonel's diary laying on his desk. Let me take a peek. And then it's just filled with like
treason.
Hitler sucks.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty bad.
Well, I guess it wasn't treason at that point, but I think wasn't free speech kind of treason?
I mean, they would have called it treason or sedition or something. Just speaking out against Hitler at the time was a big no-no. So he's talking with his general. They're trying to press forward for some offensive that they're working on. And von Stauffenberg says, hey, look, we don't have enough water for the guys. A lot of our dudes are going to die if we keep going forward. Let's hold off and go back. And the general says, well, you really are bad at following orders, and this is the shit that got you sent to Tunisia in the first place. And he says, come on, dude. You know, we can either be for Hitler or we can be for our people, and we can't be both. And I thought that was a pretty good sentiment from him. You know, it really showed that he actually cared about his men and didn't want some unnecessary loss of life just because Hitler said so, right?
Yeah.
And I think in a non-dictatorship, that's actually the mark of a really good military leader, is knowing when orders are contrary to the safety of your men, and knowing when the loss of life outweighs the possible benefits of whatever it is you're doing.
Doesn't matter at the end of the day, but at least they portrayed him really caring.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. In the end, he was a Nazi that just didn't happen to like Hitler. And I think as we get into
he still approved of the party. He just thought they were going too far.
Yeah, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. But so basically, he's sitting here arguing with the general about whether or not they're going to retreat. And then just as the general says, you know what? Okay, go ahead, make it look good on paper, but you do what you got to do. And suddenly bombs start falling on them, and fighter planes are coming in doing strafing runs. And all of his men are either killed or wounded. He himself loses some of the fingers on his left hand. He loses his right hand entirely, as well as his left eye. He's in a bad shape, right? So we don't know what happened to him. Obviously, since it's Tom Cruise and he's the star of the movie, we know he didn't die. But we cut away back to the Eastern Front and somewhere in Russia. And Hitler is making a visit to his troops that are out there. And this is the first time that we meet General Tresco. So Tresco, high-ranking general, he's also a conspirator against Hitler. He and one of his co-conspirators are working on building a bomb into a case of Cointreau that he is saying is he's sending it back to Berlin as a gift for one of his friends, right? They set the bomb up. Now, it has one of these kind of fuses where there's an acid capsule, and you crush the acid capsule, and it takes approximately 15 to 30 minutes to eat through a wire that's holding back the firing pin, which then flies forward, sets off the fuse, and blows up the bomb, right? So they're working on getting this set up. They get it right down to the last minute, the last possible second, as everybody's getting back onto Hitler's private plane to head back to Berlin. Runs up, hands it to a guy, you know, thanks for taking this back for me. And then sit and wait. And sit and wait they do. Turns out that the bomb doesn't go off. Hitler lands back in Berlin safe and sound. And now Tresco is shitting his pants because he thinks he's going to get caught with a bomb in the case of Cointreau, right? So immediately he gets a flight back to Berlin. He calls the guy he sent the box with, and he says, everything's okay. I sent you the wrong bottle. You didn't do anything with it, right? And he's like, I'm going to be in your office first thing in the morning, and I'll take it back from you. Which, if I'm on the receiving end of that phone call, I'm going to be a little bit suspicious. Why is this motherfucker willing to come all the way from Russia back to Berlin just to retrieve a fucking bottle of alcohol that he accidentally sent the wrong one? I mean, So,
but at the same time, you don't want to check.
Well, right. And that's the thing. This is a general giving you a bottle, and this guy was a colonel or a major. And so he would have been a lower ranking officer. He wouldn't have wanted to dig around in this general shit. So it was a good plan, right? Anyway, Tresco gets back to Berlin.
And it works.
He meets with one of his co-conspirators. They're worried they're going to get caught. He goes in and talks to this guy. And the guy's like, yeah, hey, since you got the wrong bottle, why don't we have a drink? The general says, hey, Hitler doesn't drink at all. What do you think he would think about the two of us drinking while we're on duty? And the guy's like, oh, man, I didn't realize you were such a fucking party pooper. And then he takes the bottle and walks away, right? So obviously the guy didn't know there was a bomb in there, just barely missed being caught.
I mean, he was low-key running. He was doing that thing where you're walking, but you're really running away.
The fuck out of that office, really running away. He did not want to get caught. And so basically we find out that one of the other co-conspirators had gotten arrested the day before. Apparently this is a common occurrence of high-ranking officers getting arrested just for no reason. And so they're looking for a new person, and they think that they might know somebody. So this is where we also meet General Ulbricht, who's another one of the co-conspirators. He flies out to, or well, at this point, von Stauffenberg is in the hospital, recovering from his wounds. So General Ulbricht shows up at the hospital to check in on him. We find out about his injuries, the extent of his injuries. But then what we see is von Stauffenberg getting up out of his hospital bed, getting dressed in his nicest dress uniform, and going down to the hospital where all of his injured men are laying there in their beds and handing out combat medals to all of them.
Also looking like he just hopped out of the shower and not like he just got brutalized the same amount of time ago as the rest of his men.
All of his men looked like shit, and he looked just kind of okay. So
he looked like Tom Cruise.
Well, now,
not even a scratch.
We
not
can
even
say
a
he looked like Tom Cruise, but what's interesting is that Tom Cruise actually looked pretty well like von Stauffenberg. And in fact, a little bit of trivia, Tom Cruise actually wanted the part because he thought that he looked like von Stauffenberg. It was not bad casting from a look-alike perspective.
Oh, looks.
Yeah.
But just from that perspective. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know what's interesting is that the look-alikeness is really uncanny from a side profile view. But if you look at them both dead on in the face, they look nothing alike.
Oh, yeah, because I'm looking at a picture of him right now, and I'm like, nah, but the whole profile, yeah. You know who does kind of look like the other guy? The guy who, he looks like another actor, though. So if they'd switched the actors, the guy who did the whole thing with the bottle, if they had switched that actor with, Tresco, and switched him with,
what's interesting, so Tresco is played by Kenneth Branagh, and he does not look at all like Tresco.
No.
But Bryan Singer actually was quoted as saying, well, if you look at Tresco's energy, it's the same energy that Branagh has. Like, okay, I can't go back in time and look at some dead Nazi's energy, but okay.
And I don't think I want to.
I'm sure you're correct, right? So he's recruited by Ulbricht, goes to the meeting of the group of treason people, and oh my God, there are like 100 of them there. How are you going to get 100 people together and try to commit treason? Like, I'm surprised nobody let the cat out of the bag much earlier.
Yeah, and I know they probably did a better job of it in reality.
Well,
but in the movie, they're just having conversations out.
So you'd be surprised. So one of the things, so we meet this guy whose name is, the fuck is his name? Karl Gordeler. Now, Karl Gordeler, he's a politician, and they're putting him up to be the next chancellor of Germany after Hitler is done away with, right? Historically, Gordeler was actually friends or acquaintances with Heinrich Himmler, Hitler's second in command. And at some point, Gordeler had met with Himmler in person and let him know that there were a bunch of people that would support him, him being Himmler, as the next chancellor of Germany, should anything happen. And now, that's a point where if Himmler was if Himmler was really staunchly pro-Hitler, you know, a really loyal right-hand man, Gordeler would not have left that meeting alive. But the fact of the matter is that he did. And it's widely believed that Himmler actually knew about this whole coup planning thing that was going on in the background. And he was just letting it happen to see how it played out. Because he was next in line to be the leader of Germany if Hitler had been killed. Yeah, I think that it might have been more open than you would expect that it should have been, right?
You know, people in power are going to try and get more power. So
yeah.
If you're number two and you could be number one, you're probably going to let it happen.
Exactly. And so, okay, so back to the movie, right? Tresco's there trying to convince von Stauffman to stay with this resistance party. He doesn't really want to. He thinks that they're all a bunch of dipshits, decides to bail off and go home to his wife and kids. While he's there with his wife and kids, I think he takes a hard look at his cute little daughter and realizes that he doesn't want his children to grow up to be like Hitler, and decides that he will, in fact, join this planned assassination attempt.
So the casting for the cute little blonde daughter, nobody else in the family has blonde hair, and the youngest child, and he was away. Like, maybe have a discussion with your wife. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. Anyway, continue.
No, I mean, you're not You're not wrong, right? But they think they cast her for the purpose of being cute. So we get to learn about Operation Valkyrie. Now, Operation Valkyrie, nowadays, the phrase Operation Valkyrie is associated with this assassination attempt, but it was actually Hitler's plan to make sure that he remained in power in case something went terribly wrong. He had this entire reserve army set up just to basically implement a military police state over entirety of Germany to ensure that he was safe and stayed in power. Tom Cruise, aka Klaus von Stauffenberg, he decides, here's what we need to do. Number one, we need to rewrite Operation Valkyrie so that the reserve troops will take over Berlin and not just the entire country. We need to have a large troop presence in Berlin. Number two, we need to get the commander of the reserve forces on our side. Number three, we need to kill Hitler.
That's usually how it is.
And so everybody's like, well, I don't know if this is really going to happen, but okay. What they're going to do is they're going to use the reserve army to depose the Nazi party by claiming, once Hitler is dead, that the SS is staging a coup post Hitler's death, right? And so how is this going to happen? Well, Hitler is primarily spending most of his time at the Wolf's Lair, which is like his field headquarters. He doesn't go out in public much at this point in the war. Somehow they're going to have to infiltrate the Wolf's Lair to be able to get close to Hitler. How are they going to do that? Coincidentally, Stauffenberg gets promoted to be the chief of staff of the reserve army, working directly for General Fromm, who is the commander of the reserves. And that gives him basically direct access to Hitler by being able to participate in Hitler's regularly scheduled briefings at the Wolf's Lair. Very, very interesting, right? How that came about, who knows? I'm taking a drink here.
I can tell. That's a lot of drinks.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
So he gets into this position of access to Hitler, and this really did happen. He was assigned as the chief of staff for General Fromm. They started working on the revised Valkyrie plan. Now, one way in which the movie differs from real life is that in real life, Tresco was actually the one who started drafting the revised Valkyrie plan.
Okay.
And now, the message that they were trying to get across once Valkyrie was put into place was, the Führer Adolf Hitler is dead. A treacherous group of party leaders has attempted to exploit the situation by attacking our soldiers from the rear in order to seize power for themselves. And then they wrote detailed instructions to occupy all of the government ministries in Berlin, as well as the SS headquarters in East Prussia, radio stations, telephone offices, and all of that stuff, including concentration camps. In the movie, we see that there's an unknown typist who is helping Stauffenberg type up all of these orders. In real life, it was actually Tresco's wife, Erica, and his secretary, Marguerite. What's very interesting is that while they were typing, they wore gloves to avoid leaving fingerprints.
Makes sense.
Tresco was really, really the heart of this coup building. And he had already tried to assassinate Hitler a couple of times. He failed. He also didn't get caught, so I guess that's okay.
try again.
I mean, until you get caught. At the center of this, during this meeting here, we also get to meet some other key members of the resistance or the coup people. Erwin von Witzleben, who was a field marshal, basically outranking a general, who was set to become the commander of all of the armies afterwards. We met Ludwig Beck, who was another general there, and we find out about a gentleman by the name of Erich Feldgebel, who is a general who apparently owes something to Stauffenberg. So Feldgebel just happens to be the commander of all of the communications people at the Wolf's Lair. So he's going to be integral to part of the plot. Once Hitler is presumed dead, Feldgebel is going to cut off all of the communications in and out of the Wolf's Lair just to make sure that nobody, and this is, we're talking high ranking people are going to be there. Himmler, Goebbels, Goring, all of these people, right? We see all these preparations, right? Tresco gets sent to the front. Stauffenberg becomes sort of in charge of the coup. In real life, it's unclear whether or not that actually happened. I don't believe that Tresco was actually sent to the front. And I think that he was still an integral part of the plot all the way through to the end. I think it's just that we, if for the movie's purposes, we needed it to focus on Stauffenberg. Now that they've got the plot all set up, right? We basically see that Stauffenberg needs to get Hitler to sign off on the revised Valkyrie order. So he goes with General Fromm to Berchtesgaden, which is Hitler's main headquarters, not the field headquarters. So they go to Berchtesgaden and they meet with Hitler, and all of his high ranking people are there. And they're all kind of making fun of Fromm and Stauffenberg for being part of the reserves. You know, they're not really, not really in the military, right? Soldier. He somehow gets Hitler to sign off on it. Now, again, I don't believe that Hitler actually signed off on the revised Valkyrie. I tried to look into it a little bit. I couldn't find any information one way or the other.
So somebody probably forged a signature.
Yeah, so for the movie's purposes, Hitler signed off on the revised Valkyrie plan without even reading it. For real life purposes, yeah, it could have happened that way, right? We see all this. This is all done. Stauffenberg decides to go to the Wolf's Lair with a bunch of explosives at the next briefing or conference or whatever on 14th of July, which happens to be Nate's birthday.
So I have this and I have the Bastille.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, Bastille Day and an attempted assassination on Hitler's life. And so Stauffenberg goes to the Wolf's Lair on July 14th, 1944. But his co-conspirators decided that for the movie's purposes, they wanted Himmler and Hitler both to be killed. Now, in real life, they wanted to get Himmler and Göring as well. They believed that it was the only way, if by killing Hitler, Himmler, and Göring all at the same time, is the only way that Valkyrie could succeed. He pulls back because Himmler wasn't there. Göring was, Hitler was, Himmler was not. So he decided to hold back. For the movie, he's given a direct order to hold back. By the time he gets back to the conference room after getting that order, everyone's already walked out and he missed his chance anyway. But in fact, in real life, he just decided everybody else wanted Himmler dead. He's going to pull back. Really, it was unusual for Himmler to actually attend these kinds of things. And so to expect him to be there at the time was odd. And historians believe that it may have been some of the co-conspirators waffling about actually wanting to go through with the plan. Because a week previously, there was a general named General Stief who was going to be attending this display of new military uniforms in Salzburg. And he was supposed to shoot Hitler at the time, but he felt like he was unable to do it. Stauffenberg is basically like, fuck it. If you want something done, we're going to have to do it myself. So he decides to go kill Hitler and then come back to Berlin to manage everything else. So he's just basically taking on this. He's taking on this entire assassination all by himself. Nobody else wants to do it. Fuck it. I'm going to do it. So anyway, so he pulls out on the 14th. Now he goes back again the very next day, because his co-conspirators decided, you know what? Fuck it. If you can kill Hitler, you can kill Hitler. So the plan is plant the briefcase with the bomb in the conference room, get a timer going, step out of the meeting, take a fake phone call, wait for the explosion, fly back to Berlin and get on with the plot. In the movie, we don't see this. This is kind of a real life thing, right? So on 15th of July, they called off that attempt at the last minute because, believe it or not, Himmler and Göring were both there. But at the very last minute, Hitler got called out of the room on other business. So Stauffenberg has to grab his fucking briefcase and get the hell out before anything, you know, goes awry. Stauffenberg sends his wife and children away. He should have done this ages before.
Yeah, seriously. I'm like, didn't this happen weeks ago? What
so
are you doing?
We get Ulbricht setting the reserve on standby. Okay. Now, this is the failed attempt. July 14th. Ulbricht orders the reserve on standby. Nothing happens. The reserve gets cut off of standby. Fromm comes up fucking pissed. How dare you order my people to standby without my permission? Now, Fromm is one of these waffly ass, wishy-washy motherfuckers that he wants to be in a role after the plot is over, but he doesn't want to be directly involved in the death of Hitler.
He doesn't want to be associated because he knows he's going to get in trouble.
So he's like,
but if they're successful, then he'll be all about it.
If your plan goes off without a hitch, I was part of it all along. If it gets into some bumpy waters and it fails, I never knew anything about it. Okay, dude, whatever. In the movie, we have this whole subplot about these communications people. They're the ones charged with receiving orders from a place and then sending them out to other places. Now, we get these dispatchers and they're just like, it doesn't really matter what orders we're getting. Our job isn't to interpret the orders and decide which orders to pass along. Our job is just to pass along the orders. So we'll do that no matter what they are. Whatever. Back to Berlin. We find out in the movie, at least, that Dr. Gordeler has to flee the country because Himmler has a warrant out for his arrest. Again, that doesn't appear to have been the case in real life, but we're adding dramatic tension. Now, we've gotten rid of Tresco, who started the plot. We've gotten rid of Gordeler, who was basically running things after Tresco left. And now that leaves von Stauffenberg, a.k.a. Tom Cruise, to be completely in charge and do whatever the hell he wants.
Which is probably better.
Right. So he decides to go back again. Now, the morning of July 20th, we see him shaving, getting ready for work. He cuts his neck intentionally so that he'll bleed on the collar of his uniform, so that when he gets back to the Wolf's Lair, he asks for a place to change his clothes because, oh shit, I got blood on my collar. I don't want to meet the Führer like this. When he's in there taking his clothes off, it turns out Now, things start to go awry. Yes. So we have two bombs. Now, we get interrupted and Stauffenberg is slow because of his wounds. He wasn't able to get the second bomb primed. So he gives it over to his aide. This is Lieutenant Hefton. Lieutenant Hefton puts the unprimed bomb into his briefcase and just goes out. But Stauffenberg says, you know what? One bomb is fucking enough. The original idea was that a bomb inside of this bunker at the Wolf's Lair would generate such a shockwave that everyone in there would just be incapacitated right away. And the second bomb was really just for a backup, just in case the first one didn't go off. Stauffenberg's like, fuck it, we don't have time. We have to kill Hitler now. This is what we're doing. Okay. So he takes the bomb. He starts heading over to the bunker, sends Lieutenant Hefton out to get the car ready. And suddenly he finds out that the meeting got moved.
Which
sucks.
I thought was dramatic
tension. It was not dramatic tension. Really happened.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in here looking at the history that I was like, oh, I thought that was for the movie, where it's not. But then the stuff that seemed like, hey, this could have happened was just for the movie.
So we're not going into the bunker. Now we have this guy, Major von Freyend. Now, von Freyend, he's a dummy. He doesn't know what's going on. He carries Stauffenberg's briefcase with him into the conference room and sets it down right next to Hitler underneath the table. He didn't know what was going on, but basically he put the bomb as close to Hitler as possible. So Stauffenberg gets a phone call and leaves the room. In the movie, we see that the briefcase falls over and gets in somebody's way. The person standing next to Hitler, this is a gentleman named Colonel Brandt, feels the briefcase fall on his foot. He gets down there and he moves it to the other side of the table leg so that it can't fall over again. Beautiful move. Bomb goes off, blows up the entire conference room. Now, there are 21 people in there, including Hitler. Only 4 of them died.
And I think also Brandt died too.
No,
right?
Actually, Brandt was okay. He was standing right next to Hitler and he moved the briefcase to the other side of the table leg that was further away from Hitler. Basically, that table leg, which was like a solid kind of piece of wood, shielded Brandt and Hitler and everybody on that side of the room from the blast. It was a very sturdily built table.
Yeah,
and so they're shielded from the blast. they're barely injured. I mean, Hitler ends up with scrapes and burns and bruises. You can actually go online and find a picture of Hitler's destroyed fucking pants after that. I mean, his pants were torn to shreds, but he was okay. I mean, barely injured. However, the people closer to the bomb on the other side of the table, four of them died and another five of them were injured. But totally, I think most of the people in the room were injured. They all pretty much ended up with ruptured eardrums and stuff. Hitler also had a ruptured eardrum from this. But in general, only four people out of 21 died. And so it was a completely fucking botched assassination attempt. Now, the explosion goes off. Now we see Stauffenberg goes out, jumps in a car with his aide, Lieutenant Hefton. They get into a car and they manage to bluff their way past all of the checkpoints and get out of the Wolf's Lair. He tossed the fucking spare bomb out of the car. There was a driver who saw this happen in real life. It seems like it was only the two of them in the car as they were going out.
Which I don't see how the two of them alone could have possibly gotten out of there without someone that they, you know, the guards and stuff.
Somehow they were able to bluff their way past. Now, in the movie, we only see them bluffing through one checkpoint. In real life, they were able to bluff their way past three checkpoints to get out of the Wolf's Lair. Insane.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's kind of what all this espionage is about, right? Bluffing everything.
Yeah. So they get out of there. Before anybody can realize that it was Stauffenberg that set the bomb, they get to the airfield. They fly back to Berlin. They get to Berlin in the afternoon. In the movie, Tom Cruise is pissed off that nobody has mobilized the reserve yet. In real life, General Feldgebel, the guy who was in on the plot with the communications, he had already called back to Berlin and told them that Hitler survived the explosion. There's no way the Valkyrie could succeed. Yeah. However, when Stauffenberg landed, he called them and said Hitler is actually dead. So they didn't know who to believe. Now, in the movie, they play this off as the communications from the Wolf's Lair were really bad and they couldn't hear over the telephone what they said.
But it's really Stauffenberg. In real life, he was just kind of being a dick.
Well, he thought, he really believed that Hitler was dead. I mean, he saw the explosion. Nobody could survive that. The building was destroyed. Normally he would be right, but they had a really
contact that's still there says no.
Yeah. So, well, now he told everybody that he thought that that was a plot by the SS to undermine him. Right. So at this point, Ulbricht issues the order for Valkyrie to be implemented. The reserve forces are mobilized and they go to Fromm's office. Fromm is like, I can't believe you fucking mobilized my people again without my orders. And Fromm decides to call Field Marshal Keitel at the Wolf's Lair, who tells him Hitler's still alive. Where is Stauffenberg? Now, Fromm says he thought that Stauffenberg was with Hitler. Now, in real life, at this point, Fromm realized that they had traced the plot back to his headquarters and that he was in danger of losing his life.
That's what happens when you have a wishy-washy person as soon as stuff starts going down. Yeah.
All of the reserve troops are now out there arresting SS people and all of this stuff. However, this was in Berlin. And they're arresting people. They send out an arrest warrant for Joseph Goebbels and all of this stuff, right? What really happened is that there's a military governor in France. He disarms the SS and all of this stuff, captures their leadership in France. He goes to one of the leaders of the SS, a gentleman by the name of Günther von Kluge, and tells him to contact the Allies. At that point, he's informed that Hitler's still alive. And he's like, well, shit. Stauffenberg and Hefton, they get to the Ministry of Defense. Fromm decides that, now this is, I'm still talking about the real plot here. Fromm decides he's not going to be in on this anymore. He's going to have Stauffenberg arrested. However, Ulbricht and Stauffenberg arrest him and appoint somebody else to take over his duties. Now, in the movie, we show that he just kind of gets arrested and locked in a closet, and he doesn't actually come back to arrest Stauffenberg until closer to the end of the movie. The city commandant of Berlin, a guy by the name of General von Heiss, he orders his troops under the command of someone named Major Remmer to go to Joseph Goebbels' headquarters and arrest him. in the movie, we see Major Remmer portrayed as a commander of one of the reserve forces. He goes to arrest Goebbels. Goebbels gets Hitler on the phone and says, hey, here's Hitler on the phone. He's alive. Okay. And that's when everything falls to shit. Himmler finally takes over, gets all of the reserves to go back and arrest Stauffenberg and his co-conspirators. And that's kind of the end of it. And in fact, that's fairly well how it played out in real life, too.
Oh, yeah. I was supposed to ask about that whole is Hitler on the phone thing.
Yes. In fact, while Major Remmer was at Goebbels' house, Hitler calls him up, lets him speak to Remmer. Hitler assures him he's still alive and says, look, I'm talking directly to you. You are in charge of what's going on in Berlin. Fix it. And so Major Remmer, commander of the troops that were surrounding Joseph Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda, they go to find Stauffenberg. In the movie, as in real life, Witzleben comes up and gets into an argument with Stauffenberg again, basically saying Hitler's still alive. This is fucked. We can't do this anymore. He gets arrested and thrown into the closet with General Fromm. In real life, he just kind of left.
he's like, ah, fuck it, bounced.
And so basically, it's a communications breakdown. Everybody starts finding out Hitler is still alive, and then they step away from the conspiracy. And so,
well, obviously,
in the movie, which again echoes real life, Fromm decides, hey, I'm going to do a court martial. I don't care that Hitler said he wanted to take these people alive. He decides to just prove his loyalty and pronounces a sentence on Ulbricht, Stauffenberg, Heften, and some other officers, pronounces them to die. Now, Beck, a general and politician, shoots himself in the head.
This is movie land. Is it also accurate?
In real life, he shoots himself and only injures himself and then gets shot in the neck by soldiers to finish the job. So they actually gave him a more dignified death in the movie than he actually had in real life.
Well, I mean, yeah, because otherwise it'd be a little, the tone would be off. This is very serious. Yeah.
The rest of them are rounded up. They're taken into the courtyard and they're executed. The reason for this is probably to keep them from revealing the fact that Fromm was actually involved.
Yeah, as hard as he tried to pretend he wasn't.
And that's kind of right at the end of the movie, right? And so we find out that Fromm is eventually executed.
Well, while he's having everybody else executed, he's standing up there on that balcony, having a smoke, looking all smug. And then underneath it, execution date. And I'm like, good for you.
Yes. Which is interesting, right? So this happened in the end of July of 1944.
And he got executed in August?
No, he got executed in March of 1945.
Okay. So he got to work a little longer.
About 8 months. But Hitler committed suicide in April of 1945.
And after this all happened, you know, they're playing the sad but still kind of triumphant music because they're martyrs now. They're showing other co-conspirators that we didn't get to see in the movie really getting hung. Yes. And so one thing that I'm seeing here, I'm looking into it because I'm like, this is really interesting. His brother was one of them. So Stauffenberg's brother was actually one of the conspirators, completely left this out of the movie. And he was one of the people who they would strangle you and resuscitate you, strangle you and resuscitate you over and over again before they hung you. So I think he got it a lot worse and he didn't even get to be in the movie.
There were the way this played out. So the movie is over, right? We find out that Fromm eventually got sort of the justice that was due to him a month before the end of the war. So the rest of these guys, we see little bits and pieces of it, but basically the ones that didn't get killed in the courtyard that night got put up on trial and expelled from the military based only on evidence from the Gestapo. And then they were sent over to the People's Court, which was basically like a kangaroo court that was always, always in favor of the prosecution. They were all fanatical Nazis. And we see a snapshot of this in the film where the head of the court is like, how could it be that a field marshal and some generals thought they knew better than our Führer, who is the godsend of the country.
Yeah.
So they all get hanged. That mirrors their real life sentence. They were all sentenced to be hanged, not just hanged, but hanged like cattle. And a lot of them actually killed themselves before the trial or before the execution.
Apparently his brother didn't get to do that.
Yeah. A lot of these were just terrible, terrible executions.
Oh, I'm looking at the picture of that crappy judge. And he actually, the actor looks like him.
Some of the casting is actually pretty good. Basically, in real life, the fact that Fromm tried to win favor by executing those guys, it was shown that he had knowledge of the plot. He failed to report it. He was arrested the next day, but he got to stay alive until March. And he was actually, his formal charge was poor performance of duty.
You can get executed for poor performance
of duty. Well, yeah, and Hitler, actually, his original death sentence was for hanging. Hitler actually commuted his sentence from hanging to firing squad, which was seen as a more honorable form of death. And a fun bit of trivia, you're familiar with Max Planck, the physicist? His son, Erwin, was actually executed for his involvement in this conspiracy as well. Now, what's funny is that in real life, the report that was given to Hitler at the end of November in 1944, after they did all their investigation, also states that the Pope was somehow a co-conspirator.
Well, yeah, because I'm looking here, it says there was over 200 people that got executed over this, and there didn't look like there was 200 people involved.
So there had been a plot by Hitler. So Pope Pius the 12th was in power in the Vatican at the time, and there had been a plot by Hitler to kidnap or murder him. And so they were basically saying that the Pope there was a co-conspirator as sort of a justification of why they should have kidnapped and murdered him before. It's really stupid.
Okay.
And we also saw that the police chief of Berlin was executed for participating in the plot. He had been a collaborator and directed all of the Berlin police forces to stand down and not interfere with the military. What he did didn't really have any influence on the actual events, but he was convicted of treason and executed anyway.
But what were the cops going to do against the military anyway?
It's just the fact that he knew about it.
Yeah.
So then Hitler, now he decided this to be a divine moment in history, and he actually had a special badge commissioned for anybody that was wounded or killed in the blast. And this is called the Wound Badge of 20th July 1944, and they were either gold, silver, or black, denoting the severity of the wound that they received. And 47 of these were awarded. And they were also given with a document personally signed by Hitler.
Yay.
And they're one of the rarest decorations ever from Nazi Germany. So I bet those things are worth a fucking pretty penny.
I mean, I don't think you'll see any on eBay anytime soon, though.
Yeah, probably not. So that's basically it for Valkyrie and the real life plot 20th July 1944 that inspired the film. We'll be right back after a brief break to give you your weekly intelligence news update. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back and we have your weekly intelligence news update. So I'm going to get right into it, starting off with a couple of COVID-19 stories. The U.S. intelligence community has actually made a very rare public statement affirming that the novel coronavirus was not man-made or genetically modified. This was issued last Thursday by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which manages the U.S. National Intelligence Program. What's surprising to me is that we have an acting director of national intelligence who's very much a loyal Trump supporter, and this is actually out of line with the narrative that the president's administration is spewing recently about how this was a virus that was generated by the Chinese. So it's actually nice to see someone in that office with a little bit of integrity. Yeah, that's really good. And so the statement says that the coronavirus did originate in China, agreeing with the majority of public health experts about the origins of the disease. And then it goes on to state that the intelligence community concurs with the wide scientific consensus that the COVID-19 virus was not man-made or genetically modified. So that's really good. So continuing on with COVID news, spy agencies from every country are participating in a worldwide competition, believe it or not, to develop a vaccine for the COVID-19 pandemic by protecting their own biomedical secrets while at the same time trying to steal other nations' research.
That sounds like fun, I guess.
I know, right? So it's basically The National Counterintelligence and Security Center, which is a part of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which coordinates the activities of our spy agencies here. Their director has said that, you know, we have every expectation that foreign intelligence services, including the Chinese Communist Party, are attempting to obtain what we're making here, but that we as a country have contacted every medical research organization that's carrying out this research and warned them that they should be very, very vigilant. However, they're not mentioning whether any data has actually been stolen by foreign intelligence agencies.
Well, mentioning whether it has or it hasn't.
Right. I mean, you know, even if we knew, we probably couldn't say, right?
Yeah.
But it's very obvious that foreign spies have become active in the field of biomedical intelligence and are attempting to steal COVID-19 data.
I would assume that active spies have always been, like, that's kind of important.
Well, so. this is the first time that we actually have official confirmation of something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, usually there's no official confirmation of anything.
Yeah. In, I guess, a kind of a feel-good COVID-19 news, Mexican drug cartels are distributing COVID-19 care packages in order to build social capital within their communities.
Well, you know what? That happens a lot with organized crime. The communities love them because they help when problems are coming up and they give medicine and stuff. And I mean,
yeah. And so one of the most well-organized care package drives is being carried out by the Sinaloa cartel. And you might know that as the cartel that's run by Joaquin Guzman, also known as El Chapo. He was arrested in 2016 and he's currently in Colorado's Supermax federal prison. So his family is continuing on his operations, including a fashion and streetwear brand called El Chapo 701. Which,
yeah, I think I heard of that.
Right. So the brand name is actually referring to an article from Forbes, which listed Guzman as the world's 701st richest person with an estimated fortune of $1 billion. And so they've got El Chapo 701 clothing out there.
Hey, you know what? I'm not mad at that.
Yeah,
because that's legit. At least that's legit. I'm not mad at that at all.
And so, you know, all of those shirts that everybody gets that have the Argentinian Che Guevara.
Yeah.
Silhouette on there. So yeah. The Sinaloa cartel are handing out t-shirts that have a stencil of El Chapo on them that reminds people of the Che Guevara. And they're giving out cardboard boxes that have his face on them and information about
Honestly,
the company.
If they sold those t-shirts online, I bet you a lot of people out
I'm
here
sure
would get
they'd
it.
Make a fortune, right? And so, but they're giving away not just clothes, but they're also giving out face masks that have the stencil of his face on it, and hand sanitizer, cooking oil, rice, sugar, salt, toilet paper, those kinds of things. So they're trying to build community and support, community support, which is what they're kind of using as a buffer between them and law enforcement. So police agencies such as the DEA are...
they don't like it, but you know what? Yeah. Usually organized crime in the area does try to take care of the community so the community takes care of them.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily because they actually feel a connection to the community. It's more just that... That helps them to have that buffer between them and law enforcement. It's an interesting relationship, right? Yeah. So another thing, so pivoting away from COVID-19 news now.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you can't avoid it. It's out there. This is what we're going through, right? So, but pivoting away from that, the U.S. could begin withdrawing intelligence assets from the U.K. Due to Huawei's major role in implementing 5G out there. Reports have said that the United States could end all of their sensitive intelligence operations and fully withdraw their assets from the United Kingdom if the U.K. proceeds with plans to hire Huawei, a Chinese company, to upgrade the country's telecommunications network. So we've already banned Huawei. And some other Chinese manufacturers from critical infrastructure here in the United States based on an executive order from President Trump over the summer last year.
Which, honestly, you know, I'm not a fan, but I feel like intelligence-wise, it's not a bad move, you know?
Yeah, and it's really important to understand that any company that is incorporated in China automatically has an obligation, a legal obligation to the Chinese government to participate in intelligence gathering activities on behalf of the government. Yeah. If they don't, their company could become seized by the government and all of their executives could be thrown in prison, which in China is not a very good thing to happen.
Well, yeah. And that's why I'm like, hey, you know what? This is actually, because usually Trump's moves against China are racist in nature, but this one I agree with. Like, we can't just have all that stuff out there.
To maintain a non-political stance, right? Huawei being controlled by the Chinese government is not a good thing for Western intelligence services. So most Western intelligence agencies view the company as being really close to the Communist Party. And Washington has been a leader in the worldwide campaign to limit their abilities to build that infrastructure. And so notably, Australia and Canada are supporting us in the concern that the Chinese telecommunications company might facilitate global wiretapping on behalf of the spy agencies. And now, you know, no matter how you look at it, I don't want any country spying on me, let alone a foreign country on my country's own soil, right? And yeah. Huawei, unfortunately, is one of the main companies out there leading the charge for implementation of 5G.
Well, it would be great if we could do that ourselves, but we have such a problem with getting any infrastructure like put into place that I don't know. I think if we get our stuff together, we wouldn't need them. You know?
It's very challenging, right? Because American made hardware is very expensive. The fact of the matter is that we pay our workers better than almost any country in the world. And so all of these manufacturing capabilities are outsourced, located into different countries where they pay their workers less. And so you have companies like Cisco. Cisco makes enterprise networking equipment such as 5G modems and stuff like that that would be required to implement this infrastructure, but it's 4 to 5 times more expensive than something from another country simply because we pay our workers more. So it's really challenging. Either you set aside the budget to do it right, or you have to go out to these other countries. So we're in a place that's very sort of flexible right now.
Yeah, but it's not like the money's not there. It's there. It's just being used in ways that it could be used better.
Yeah, and the budgets are set at the beginning of years and stuff like that. Everybody wants to save a dollar, right? It's very challenging, and we'll see how this plays out going forward. Next up, however, now you may have heard about this, the alleged coup around the beginning of May that happened in Venezuela. Several plotters were sailing on speedboats from Colombia, heading to the coast of Venezuela. And they were either captured or killed by Venezuelan armed forces. Now, what's interesting is that there's a company here in the United States called Silvercorp. They're a private security group, and they're led by a gentleman who used to be a sergeant in the Army Green Berets. He actually posted on Twitter about this coup that they were coming up with. And then literally 12 hours later, there was a post on Twitter saying that they had all been captured in Venezuela. Why would you, if you're doing a coup, why would you post about it on Twitter?
That's what?
Yeah, he posted about it on Twitter and then tagged Donald Trump in the post. It doesn't make any fucking sense.
What?
I know. It's completely ridiculous. So the Venezuelan state television aired last week an interview with one of the two Americans that are facing charges of participating in the coup. And they've basically gotten him to admit that, yeah, they were in the middle of doing a coup. U.S. citizen Luke Denman appears to claim that he was part of a group of coup plotters whose mission was to take control of the Bolivar International Airport in Caracas, Venezuela, and that basically they wanted to capture President Maduro and transport him back to the United States. Now, the Venezuelan government is claiming that the coup was sponsored by us, the White House, the DEA, the Colombian government, and the main rival for President Maduro down there, a gentleman by the name of Juan Guaido. He is kind of seen by most Western countries as the rightful leader of Venezuela. He won the election, but you know how that goes. And so United States obviously has denied that they were involved. Who knows? And a former CIA operations officer said last week as well that the coup plot was probably penetrated by Venezuelan spies very early on in the planning stages. So they probably didn't have much of a chance to succeed.
Well, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And so, tried.
And so finally, in intelligence news for this week. So the DGSE, France's equivalent to the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, they're seeking to expand their mission, but they're being frustrated in that attempt by the poor quality of job applicants. So,
really?
Yeah, they can't get any. They started advertising their vacancies on YouTube and LinkedIn. Okay. Even though they're a very secretive organization, I mean, there's much less known about them than is known about the CIA.
But then they're just up there on LinkedIn.
Yeah, terrible. And so the agency said that they received 400 applications for 14 positions that were advertised in January. And of those 14 positions, 10 of them required knowledge and understanding of foreign affairs and geopolitical developments, while two of them wanted logistical and administrative expertise, and the other two needed fluency in Arabic. But they couldn't fill the positions. Basically, what they said is that the job candidates showed, quote, markedly limited grasp of global geopolitics, and their knowledge of intelligence work was even more limited. And even minimum requirements, like a resume free of spelling mistakes, was rarely met.
So what they needed to do was you get to find, like, you know, people who are majoring in geopolitics, you know? Well, and be like, hey, grad students.
The majority of the applicants had graduate degrees.
But they couldn't not get misspellings on the.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's ridiculous. Right. Candidates appeared for interviews underprepared, and their level of knowledge was what they considered unacceptable for someone wishing to join the ranks of the DGSE.
I mean, I would hope that they have. You can't just say, oh, well, I guess, fuck it. We'll take the dumbass from down the lane. Right. Let's give him a job anyway.
So it's May. These jobs were posted in January. Now, 12 of the 14 have been filled, but the remaining two posts, which require fluency in Arabic, have remained unfulfilled for want of suitable candidates. So France is pretty much fucked on the intelligence hiring scenario here.
Well, I wish them luck.
Yeah.
And also maybe they need to work on, y'all should be able to write a resume without having spelling errors.
I know. And the literacy rate in France is like 99%. So
literate. I'm does kind of not shocked mean by competent. That.
Well, literate I guess you're right. So anyway, that does it for this week's intelligence news update. Big thank you again to Nate for being here again this week. Really appreciate it. Love.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the movie this time around.
Yeah. And, you know, guys out there, to my 8 people who listen on a regular basis,
we appreciate you.
Nate actually had two of his teeth pulled today. So he's in excruciating pain with blood running out of his mouth while he's talking to you for the last hour.
I've been waiting so I can try to take this pain pill because it's starting to really bump. So
I hope you appreciate his sacrifice. So
because we appreciate you.
Yeah. So that's it for this week. Join me again next week when I'll be joined by special guest co-host Najayla Ree to talk about a blaxploitation spy movie called That Man Holt. It's going to be a really cool discussion, so I hope you all join us again. Keep safe. Wash your fucking hands.
Yes, please.